Mark Feinsand, executive reporter with MLB.com. I had a chance at the end of spring training to sit down with Rockies senior vice president and general manager Jeff Breidich. We talked about a variety of topics, including his career, why signing a shortstop slash outfielder to be the Rockies' new first baseman was a good idea, and why Nolan Arenado may be one of the game's most anonymous superstars. Enjoy. So Jeff, you caught and played outfield at Harvard, where you were a captain as a senior. How did your playing experience in college help you as you moved into a front office role?
The ability to understand struggle and disappointment and having to persevere, being a very average college player, and having to do that at the same time trying to achieve academically at a very challenging institution. There were a lot of life lessons in there. A lot of good things too, though. Back then we had a very good program, and we were accustomed to winning a lot. And whether it was winning the league and going on and playing in the NCAAs or going and beating bigger programs that had kind of become part of who we were at that time period, and being able to see that and experience that was just important for me. How it translates to the front office, I think, a couple different ways. It's funny, when we didn't really think about necessarily front office, baseball front office back then. I mean, the dream was to play, right? So, but as I look back at it now, some of the things that I learned about just purely about the game, and especially about pitching, and some of the intricacies of that, because I came from the Midwest. I mean, we played a lot of baseball, but we didn't play certainly as much baseball as the guys on the West Coast, the guys down in Texas, the guys down in Florida. So there were a lot of things that I had to learn, and I did that in college, and I hope that those things stuck with me in terms of what is important to create winning baseball.
Yeah, there were probably some months in Wisconsin where baseball wasn't really possible. I grew up in New York. We had the same thing.
Yeah, pretty cold.
You characterized yourself as an average college player.
Yeah.
You said the dream for all of you is to play. Did you think there was a chance that you'd be able to pursue a professional career?
Yeah. By the time I got to my senior year, I mean, I think that the writing on the wall was pretty clear. By the very end of it, it was, flashing neon lights.
Crystal
right?
clear.
Crystal clear. You have that, you grow up having that dream. If you truly love the game, I think the way that we do in this industry, I think it's natural, and it's almost universal that you grow up thinking, why not? Why wouldn't I want to continue this and do this as long as I could possibly do it? I think the realist in me, came to the forefront certainly by senior year, and probably in the back of my mind even before that, seeing other people get the attention of scouts or just play better than me, just some self-evaluation skills. And that's okay. I mean, it was tough at the time, but, just like anybody else, you pick yourself up and you move on. And honestly, going to and experiencing an institution like Harvard, it gives you some perspective. If you're not in awe at some point of the people around you, you're probably not paying much attention, right? So, but at that time, at that senior year, sometime in there, it was, okay, so what's next here? And is there a way to make baseball a part of what's next?
Speaking of that, several GMs that I've spoken to started other careers after college and then decided to jump into baseball. Did you know right away that you wanted to find a career in baseball?
Not really. I had, teaching, coaching, part of my family, large part of my family. My father is a career, high school teacher and a football and baseball coach, 45 plus years at doing it. My brother now in Chicago at Loyola Academy is a teacher and a coach, head of the baseball program there. So that was kind of a possibility for me, or so I thought, and through a couple conversations, kind of organic, not necessarily, you know, thought out or planned out. It was, okay, well, if I feel good about having that, I can go back to Wisconsin, I could do the teaching and the coaching thing, but what else if in the game? And, you know, it was literally just sending out resumes and trying to make connections, and I got lucky, to be honest with you. I think I was fortunate to get an interview for an internship in the commissioner's office, and I was lucky to be offered that job. I don't think I did anything overtly special or, you know, off the wall or memorable. I think, you know, I just got lucky, and I think I did a good job in the interview, and I think I got lucky because there were other people that they were interviewing too. And so there's that element of timing and luck involved in all these things.
You worked in the commissioner's office for 3 years?
Four.
4 years?
Yeah.
Did you think at any point during that time that you might just have a career working for Major League Baseball in the commissioner's office? There are people there who are lifers.
Absolutely there are. And 4 years there, you get a pretty good, if you're paying attention, you get a pretty good understanding of what that means, right? Life in the commissioner's office, and kind of the landscape there. Now, granted, it's changed a lot. I mean, I left in 2000 at the end of 04. It's changed a lot over the last, you know, 12, 13 years there. It's grown. It's expanded. It's in ways multiplied.
There's a new guy at the top.
Absolutely. Yeah, new leader. So it's not the same, you know, place that necessarily that it was back then. The way that I looked at it after probably 3 years there, I kind of knew that maybe my expectations for myself, my hopes and dreams for myself, if I were going to stay in this industry, probably were not going to be met or be able to be met in the commissioner's office. So I started to brainstorm, and I, you know, did, okay, I need that. So there was that. What's the future? Where do I want to live? You know, planning on that time back then, about to get engaged and be married to my college sweetheart, and where did we want to live and where do we want to raise a family? That certainly played into it, but also, you know, career-wise, what's the goal here? And some of it was needing and desiring and feeling a draw towards the competitiveness of baseball, which is kind of tamped down in the commissioner's office to a certain degree. That you get an unbelievable broad perspective on the industry, and you make a lot of contacts and you meet a lot of people, and you are potentially dealing with a lot of different things, but you don't have that daily ownership and you don't have that daily competitive outlet that you do with a club. So I felt like I needed that if I was going to try to continue in this industry. And then I was running a parallel course. You know, you brought it up, you know, other guys going elsewhere and then coming into the industry. I was, you know, if I can't stay in this game, if an opportunity with a club is not in the offing for me, then, you know, I was going to go back to school and get an MBA somewhere. And so running that parallel course as well at that time.
You move on to the Rockies front office, and over the next decade, you hold jobs in minor league operations, player development, among others. Was, as you made your way through that, did you have your eye on eventually becoming a big league GM?
At the time, way back when, 04, 05, not really. I don't think I knew enough back then, to be honest, about the job. I was very interested in seeing it firsthand, and Dan O'Dowd certainly did an incredible job with me, as well as with others down line. I mean, there's a tree there that kind of stems from Dan and the Rockies over the course of the last decade. So he did an incredible job of me in terms of showing me, you know, the ropes in over a long period of time, but just kind of exposing and you know, letting me be involved in that process. So over time, it became clear that it was something that I felt like I would hope and you know, I could do, that aspire to do. Felt like over time, if I learned some lessons and I over time gained some experience, that I might be positioned to be able to do the job. But coming into it initially, it's not like it was I just wanted to get more experience and do a good job at whatever I was asked to do back at that time.
You mentioned Dan. You worked for him for a long time. Mm-hmm. What did you learn most from him?
I think, well, there's a lot of, I mean, we spent a long time together, so there was a lot of things. If you ask me the one thing, I think the scope of the job, the responsibility that you feel to the organization at large, you know, it's not easy. You know, it's a very, the scope is large, and it's a people game, and there's a lot of people involved, and the more, you know, the more intimate connections you can develop with those people over time, or try to maintain over time, it can be key to how well your organization does. And you know, I think the other thing is Dan always was pushing the envelope. He was pushing the envelope and trying to, you know, make sure that people weren't kind of sitting on their laurels or, you know, comfortable or ready. He always wanted to kind of push you into a zone of uncomfortable, you know, uncomfortableness, for lack of a better word. And that was to grow. You know, it was to grow the organization. It was to grow you as an individual. And I think he did that well.
Did you always envision he would become a big TV star someday?
I can't say that I did. But, you know, I can't claim I have an eye for TV talent. So.
Baseball talent, maybe. TV talent, not so much. I've noticed teams are loaded with Ivy Leaguers in their front offices these days. Aside from the obvious education that you all received, which we know is excellent, Do you think there's a reason that trend has taken place?
I don't know. The way I look at that, you know, college was something I did for 4 years a long time ago, right? And there are a lot of great non-Ivy League executives, not just in baseball, across other sports, across other industries that are very successful at what they do. There are a lot of Ivy League executives that are very good. There are a lot of Ivy League executives that, you know, or executives with Ivy League educations that don't do a very good job. It's tough for me to speak for the other guys that went to Ivy League schools, but I don't show up every day saying, okay, I'm a Harvard educated executive. It's something I did a while ago. Did it challenge me at that time of my life to, you know, in ways that I had never even come close to being challenged before? Absolutely. Did I, as I said earlier, was I in awe of the people around me at times because of their abilities and their skills and their intelligence level? And did those people push me? Absolutely. Did I grow up a lot because of coming from Milwaukee to Boston, you know, somewhat sheltered 18-year-old kid going to a big city and living there and experiencing, you know, some of the things that the East Coast has to offer? So there was a lot of growth there over those 4 years. And at a place like that, is it special growth? Potentially. But, you know, that was a long time ago. And so there's a lot of time between then and now to either continue on that path and try to make good on that and be as good as you can possibly be, and there's a lot of time to screw it up. I'd like to say that, you know, I think there's a lot of truth to an Ivy League school being on a resume, giving you potential looks and getting a foot in the door, but I think after that, it's all on the individual, and you got to own that.
I read an interview recently where you said you try to learn from the way some NFL teams operate, including your hometown Packers. Mm-hmm. Paul DePodesta made the jump from baseball to football, and the chief strategy officer for the Browns for the last 14, 15 months.
Right.
Do you think this could become a trend, or do you think he's a unique case?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, he's certainly seemingly the first to do it, to make that jump. There are a lot of shared skills among the different major sports industries. There are a lot of shared experiences in terms of how you have to, the types of decisions that you have to make, how you have to prepare yourself to make decisions. But there are also a huge host of differences too. And there's a lot of uniqueness when you start to compare the sports industries to each other. And so, it's tough, you know, not speaking for Paul, but I imagine that there was a pretty good learning curve for him initially. And he's an incredibly intelligent human being, so I imagine he acquitted him. You know, he equipped himself quite well, pretty quickly, to some of those things he had to learn. But it wouldn't necessarily shock me. But I don't. It's tough to say one person is a trend, right? I mean, well, you know, I think everybody's kind of got their eye and see how this goes. And the Browns are an interesting kind of case study, anyway. Regardless of Paul's involvement or not. So they're kind of uniquely situated right now in a lot of different ways to you know, take some huge steps and make a lot of growth. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Right, it would have been different if you'd gone to the Patriots and just become a part of their operation.
Probably.
Right.
Yeah, right. I mean, if you're stepping into a kind of that well-oiled machine. Didn't seem like that's what Paul wanted to do, right?
Right.
I mean, he wanted to kind of
looking for a challenge,
that's
probably about as big as
that's
there
right.
is, right?
That's right.
Speaking of challenges, what are the challenges of building a team that plays at Coors Field?
Most of them are similar to any challenge at any place. For us, it's, as we've talked a lot about before, it's the versatility, positional versatility with our position players. It's depth of players on your roster, depth off the roster, guys that are developing and waiting, kind of waiting in the wings and can take the ball and, to use a football term, take the ball and run with it when they're given the opportunity. Pitching, we've made a commitment to kind of flood our process with pitching and try to do so in as many different ways as possible. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we're interested in taking all comers. It's a little bit more specific and intentional than that. But increasing and maximizing our athleticism in addition to that as much as we can, knowing that pitching and defense ultimately, in my opinion, humble opinion, lead to championships or direct you towards championships. So, all those things, not so unique in other places, but or in comparison to other places. But for us, it's, some of the smaller things about playing at altitude that are part of our reality come into play more often than they would at other places. So rest and recovery, the grind of a full season, 6 month, hopefully 7 month season, doing that there, it forces us to at times make different decisions maybe, or think about things, consider things that other organizations don't have to. And that's okay. I mean, that's just part of who we are. But we have to, all those other things that I just talked about, we got to make sure that those are in good shape and in good order so that we can adjust on the fly or that we can address some of the, fatigue or, some of the other issues that come up at times from playing in altitude.
I mean, every team has its own challenges in some
Absolutely.
Aspect or another. You think about
Absolutely.
The teams in New York, they have to consider how a player might handle the media pressure or,
right.
or that kind of thing. So it's
playing,
it's just a matter of
hitters. Yeah, hitters for ages, right? Hitters hitting in Seattle or San Francisco
right.
or San Diego
versus
huge,
New York or Baltimore.
Huge
right.
ballparks, where those ballparks that tend to favor pitchers. Hitters got the same complaints at times there that pitchers do with us in Denver, right? It's, and so. Let's just look what you said. Every team's kind of got its unique little things that it's got to address and it's got to tackle and it's got to become experts at.
Troy Tulowitzki was the face of this franchise for a very long time. How difficult was the decision to trade him?
It was a difficult decision at the time, as it should be. I think when you're talking about a player of his caliber, somebody that had been drafted by the organization. And our, Billy Schmidt and our guys did a great job in terms of knowing who he was as a player, and saying, yeah, this is the guy that is the right pick, for us as our next shortstop. And didn't spend a very long time in the minors and hit the big leagues and was ready for it. And the rest is history, right? So thinking back on that now, it's been a couple years. With the emergence of Trevor Story, with some of the ways and things that we've been focused on trying to improve ourselves, I do feel like it was a necessary trade for the organization with where we were at the time and what our needs were. And being willing to bet on somebody, having known Trevor Story for really his entire career with us at that point as a minor leaguer, betting on him being, you know, the kind of the heir apparent and being ready to kind of tackle that. Now, we didn't know that he was going to do what he did last year in the fashion that he did it, but having confidence that that we had a young man who was ready to take that next step in his career and become become the shortstop for us, the everyday guy, and take on that responsibility and be ready for that responsibility. That helped in terms of making a tough decision like the two-year trip.
We've reached a point where every team in baseball has an analytics department, some bigger than others. One GM told me he's even seen scouts beginning to take to analytics because some of the metrics are backing up what they've been seeing on the field all these years. Was it important to put the whole scouting versus analytics debate to bed and for everybody just to sort of accept that it's all part of it?
I think it's outside of the industry. I think fans and media and book writers and movie makers and, you know, casual fans, intense fans. People that enjoy, you know, thinking about the game, controversial. Outside, I think it's topical and it's something to discuss and it seems like it has meaning. I think inside the industry, for the most part, especially where we're at now, it's this whole one versus the other is just, it's just not all that relevant or true. There are parts of this game that we can forget pretty quickly, you know, and some of the smaller parts. I mean, stats have been around forever, right?
Sure.
Check any back of any baseball card. Scouting's been around forever. Technology has changed, which has increased our access to stats and the different types of stats that we have. So that, I think, more than anything, has brought statistical analysis to the forefront more than people trying to poo-poo scouting or the scouting process or the art and the skill of scouting human beings, because that is still really hugely important. It's really not a versus situation. It's a how do we best combine these things and mold these things and help both of those processes get better through that combined effort or that combined learning or the challenging of convention, whether it's statistics convention or it's scouting convention. When things are challenged in good, healthy ways, then usually there's growth involved. And so I think that's kind of where we're at. We forget things. And we forget that years ago, the teams were shifting against Ted Williams. And, all of a sudden shifting is a big deal now, but it's not like, there are very few original ideas in this game. Now, we might focus on certain things more now than in years past or eras past, but, I don't believe or buy into this whole scouting versus analytics. It's just, it's not realistic, at least not for us anyway.
When analytics first hit the scene, it was viewed as a tool that small market teams were using to try to, catch up with the big market teams that they didn't have the same financial resources. Do you think teams now that everybody's has an analytics department and it's more widely used league-wide, do you think teams are out there looking for the next big thing that's going to try to give them a competitive advantage?
Yeah, absolutely. And we should, right? I mean, that's and I think nutrition and wearable. I think technology. We're just probably scraping the surface here, especially trying to read the tea leaves of Rod Manfred and some of the things that he believes in terms of taking the industry into the next generation. Wearable technology is probably going to be there here and be commonplace at some point soon. The way that we train our athletes, the way that we feed our athletes, not just at the major league level, but all the way down to rookie ball, and into the Dominican, you know, DSL league. I mean, that's there are things I think that in that way especially that we're going to probably take steps forward here, potentially in leaps and bounds over the next however many years. But yeah, and that's we should. I mean, the teams should be looking to. It's a competitive business, and if you can gain an edge and do it legally within the rules, then yeah, you should be pushing the envelope that way.
Do you think StatCast is changing the way fans are looking at the game?
In what way? What do you mean?
Well, some of the metrics, exit velocity, spin rate, route efficiency are more widely available to fans than they've ever been before, and so it seems like it's entering the
common vernacular.
Yeah. You know, exit. I remember Brian Cashman would talk to us about exit velocity 4 years ago, and we'd look at him like he was, you know, crazy.
Right.
Now all of a sudden, it's showing up in broadcasts. And yeah. Do you think fans are maybe viewing the way that they watch the game a little differently?
Yeah, probably. But aren't we all? I mean, we're
right.
You know, I mean, cable television is changing, right? I mean, everybody's watching games on their phones or their iPads or, you know, streaming this, streaming that. I mean, just the way that you know, without getting into specifics, just generally the way that people are watching sports now, it's not just baseball, is changing. And some of that has to do with the changing landscape of television. Some of it has to do with technology advances and the ease of which now we have access to very specific and immediate data points, you know, in-game, real-time. Yeah, it's absolutely changing it. And some of it's great, you know. Some of it's a lot of fun to watch. I mean, when they replay, you know, a guy making a diving catch in the gap, and they can show you where he started and show you the path, the exact path he took to get to that ball. It's kind of cool. It you know, and it's understandable that fans would get excited about those things. And I would guess, it's purely a guess, but I would guess that those sorts of things are here to stay. I don't think they're going to revert back to, you know, 1980s grainy television watching baseball or football or basketball. You know, I think those things are here to stay.
I would hope not.
Yeah.
That'd be slightly
disappointing.
You watch some old stuff on ESPN Classic or old tapes,
right,
and stuff, and you're like, wow, that's what TV looked like back then.
And we were happy, right?
And we were happy with it.
It
was in color. What more did you want, right? Let's look at this year's team a little bit. Why was Bud Black the right choice for you as your new manager?
Where to begin, right? It became, I've said it before, I think we had a good interview process. I think we had a good grouping of interviewees, and he was one of our late ones in the process, and it was fairly clear pretty quickly that how he talked about the game, how he viewed the game, the breadth of and depth of his experiences in the game, what his goals were, what, you know, for the rest of his personal career, how he viewed this organization, his experiences with the organization from the periphery a little bit, having been in the MLS for a long time, but even more specifically with where he saw, from an outsider's perspective still, but where he saw the team, how we were situated, what our potential future might be here in the near future. His desire to, you know, his comfort in the division, his desire to, you know, ultimately, if he could control it, be on the West Coast or close to the West Coast from a family perspective. You know, I mean, there was just a lot of things that kind of added up and became pretty clear that he was the right guy for us at this time, and I think his excitement for the opportunity matched our excitement to get to know him, and ultimately that led to what's been so far a great decision. I mean, he's been as advertised and then some in terms of his personality and in the way his leadership ability, his willingness to lead and desire to lead and having very specific ways of doing it, you know, both from a high expectation standpoint and a standard standpoint, but also, you know, that element of fun and enjoying this ride that we're on right now. It's been good for us, and it's been fun to watch.
you signed Ian Desmond to play first base for a $70 million contract, despite the fact that he had never played an inning there before. Mm-hmm. What made you believe that that was a good fit?
A few different things. One was that just, you know, he brought up the position. Positionally, it's, you know, he was never pushed out of the infield. His opportunity last year for playing time and for a contract on a very good team was the outfield, and he took it and ran with it, right? And in short order became their starting center fielder, which is not, it's not an easy thing. It's not a simple thing to do. So in talking to him about that and in discussing how that all went down and the work that he put into it, it wasn't just some happy accident. The work that he put into it was huge. The belief that he had in himself that he was going to be able to do it no problem, go from shortstop to center field, and he did it. So that, you know, the way that he talked about first base in that way, the understanding that he had of the importance of the position as it relates to a high functioning infield, that it's not just some throwaway defensive spot, that his ability to remember the very talented defensive first baseman that he had played with and the less than talented defensive first baseman he'd played with and how that changed how the whole operation worked or infield wise from over the course of a long season. There's a lot of other things as well that went into it, but it was just a sense of confidence that, you know, this is not going to be that big of a deal for this guy. And we're going to be committed, fully committed, and on the same page together to make sure that he becomes the very best first baseman that he can. And he's a plus athlete. At the age of 30, 31, he's still a very, you know, he's a very good athlete, moves very well. And we felt like his athleticism and his versatility positionally, once he did learn the position, was going to be a great fit. Right-handed bat, power bat. If you look at, you know, the last few years of his career in some interesting situations, you know, going from Washington to Texas to playing different positions, he still produced offensively. And adding that, all of that to, you know, what we felt was already a very talented offensive group and defensive group, was it, you know, going to be a plus. Now, he didn't think he would break his hand being hit by a pitch. It's unfortunate, but, you know, all of those things kind of combined, you know, it seemed like a good decision for us.
The team in your position might have surveyed the free agent landscape, thought about him, said, we have a shortstop, we have a center fielder, and moved on. Do you often try to think outside the box when looking at players out there?
You know, you know, I think this was a good example of good conversation and good brainstorming with our front office, along with Buddy Black, and trying to be true to the vision that we had for this team moving forward. And we felt like Ian fit that vision. And you know, as long as certain conditions were met about making sure that the transition for him to first base went well. Commitment to the work involved in the wintertime, everybody, Ian, me, Buddy, our coaches, and mapping that out, knowing that we were going to have time if we could sign him to create first base for him. As long as we were going to commit to each other and create a plan and actually execute that plan, then it was, if we were going to, you know, for lack of a better term, half-ass it, or any piece of that puzzle was not going to be fully in, then it would have given us major pause. But the fact that we were everybody was fully on board and fully committed to it, and we went out and did it, you know, I mean, it, we just felt like, you know, whether it's out of the box or not, I don't know, but you know, we felt like we saw a person and a player and an athlete that was a good fit. And if we could get everybody on the same page and execute this plan, it was going to be a great fit for us. And he broke his, you know, we did it and he broke his
sure.
hand. And
well,
so,
that happens.
You know, it happens. And so now we're looking forward to him getting healthy and being a major part of the offense and defense.
Greg Holland was one of the most successful closers in the game before he had his Tommy John surgery. Did you see him as a potentially high reward signing at a reasonable price?
Definitely high reward potential. You know, it's guys coming back from Tommy John surgery. It's never ever a sure thing, but it is a, you know, it's become, unfortunately, it's become a very popular and a very routine surgery and recovery process. It's not 100%, but you know, we felt like we had an understanding of the person in a lot of ways because of the history that Steve Foster and Greg Holland had together in Kansas City. And so understanding the human being and what this guy was all about in adding that to where he was at in his career, coming back from Tommy John, rehabbing, you know, his own expectations for himself through that process, how he was going to go about doing that, the seriousness of which he takes his career and his work and his responsibility to, you know, saving games and shutting down and getting outs and shutting down innings and all of that, you know, there was you know, comfort in that with the situation that he was in terms of taking a chance on high risk, high reward chance on a guy that had, you know, just had surgery, but had been extremely, extremely elite just prior to breaking down.
People who don't watch the Rockies on a regular basis might not realize just how good Nolan Arenado's past 2 years have been. Mm-hmm. How much fun has it been for you to watch him blossom into the superstar that he's become?
I think it's been just as much fun for us internally here to watch that as it has been for our fans to watch it. I know there's a great amount of pride with our scouts and especially our amateur scouts, the guys that saw him as a, I mean, if you go back to his draft video as a high schooler, you know, you look at it and it's kind of a pudgy guy, kind of, you know, there's still some baby fat on there and kind of a unique swing path. He was actually catching at the time. You can see him both play third base in that video and catch. And our guys did an incredible job of saying, okay, if this were to happen, this guy could be special. And for Billy Schmidt to go, okay, that, you know, in a high draft pick, high round, this is the guy. I believe in this guy. And then for Nolan and all of our coaches and everybody around Nolan for years to just kind of help him get to, you know, where he is at now, it's extremely rewarding. And you're right, he doesn't, you know, he has not gotten probably the same pub or the same notoriety as some other guys across the game. You know, we get spoiled on a daily basis watching Nolan because there are plays that we've been so accustomed to him, especially defensively, we get so accustomed to him making plays that are just kind of otherworldly. And, you know, when he doesn't make a routine play, it's like, you know, what the, but he's a human being.
Right.
Guys make errors. You know, he spoils us that way. That's just how good he is.
I feel like he and Paul Goldschmidt may be the two most anonymous, you know, top five players or top eight players in the league that we've seen in a long time.
You know, and they're both seemingly understated. You know, they don't get on Twitter and they don't make
They're not flipping bats.
They don't do a lot of things that either on or off the field that call attention to themselves. They go out and they play and they play their butts off and their focus. You know, it's tough to speak for Goldschmidt.
Sure.
You know, but watching him for years in this division, you know, it just seems like the focus is on the field, and that's certainly the case for Nolan. And you know, sometimes that goes, you know, unrewarded in terms of publicity or notoriety. But if he isn't one of the top five players in the game, you know, it's tough to imagine who the other four guys are, or five guys that are better than him.
Do you think John Gray can take the next step this season to become
Yes.
a true number one?
Yes. You know, the number really doesn't matter. I mean, it's easy to say number one, number two, whatever. The number doesn't matter. Can John Gray take another step and become even better than he is right now? Absolutely. You know, it's through experience, you know, just increased belief and confidence, self-confidence, but true belief in who he is and how he's going to attack hitters and put us in position to win, you know, hopefully every game that he pitches. So, yeah, there's, you know, he is still young in some ways in terms of his major league experience, and so there's growth and there's growth potential. So, absolutely, Kim.
Young, controllable talent is the most valuable thing in baseball in terms of payroll, in terms of just everyday lineup. How rewarding has it been to see players you've developed here, guys like Charlie Blackmon, Trevor Story, Dave Dahl, form an important core of this team's future?
In terms of who we are as an organization, it's I think it is vitally important for us. It's not always a given that guys like each other and fall in love with each other as teammates and as friends. There is a lot of that with this core right now, I think. And there's been a lot of work put in. I mean, that just hasn't happened by surprise or by coincidence. I mean, that there's a lot of time spent around each other. There's, you know, whether it's in the wintertime here at Salt River, and guys choosing to care about each other and choosing to be around each other a lot and push each other, especially in the wintertime, and not just during the season. So that is part of, you know, we do believe here that's going to help take us to where we want to go. That's going to be part of the equation, you know. And I think you guys, whether it's players, whether it's people in the front office, or other parts of the organization, we have one chance. You know, we have one chance in this life and in this baseball life. People rarely get two chances. You got one shot to make it good, make it right, and in doing it with people that you care about and people that you like and respect, you know, it makes it sweeter. So why not work hard at making that part of our reality?
How do you rate your farm system right now?
I like it. Don't really care, you know, what the rankings are.
Rate's the wrong word. How do you assess your farm
system? Yeah, right now? I think we, you know, the... I believe it's balanced in ways that we've been focused on. I think you know, we've balanced it between the pitchers and the position players to a certain degree, and I think that as long as the young players continue to develop, I do feel like there are waves of impactful talent that. You know, there's three or four waves of impactful talent that could hit us over the next, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years, and that's important to not have a major hole or a major gap in that system. Now, things happen. Players get hurt, trades happen. Players don't develop as rapidly or just as well as you think they will. But as we sit here right now, I do feel like we are strong, and if we can keep people healthy and keep people developing, that we're well situated to continue to add impactful guys to our major league roster in the near future, like we have, you know, with guys like Story and Dahl and Tapia and Gray and, you know, Anderson, and, you know, guys that are, like you said, are kind of part of that core, and that young developing core at the major league level.
Last one for you. How do you assess the overall state of the National League West?
Tough, talented, very talented, and that's great. That's how it should be, right? You know, if we're going to be the best, we got to beat the best. And I'm a firm believer that iron sharpens iron, and whether that's internal, it definitely happens here internally, but it happens externally as well. I mean, the better teams you play, the better you are. That's why. In the NCAA, they pay attention to strength of schedule, right? I mean, you know, if you play better teams throughout your season, as long as you have health, you oftentimes are best situated for success at the end of the season and in the postseason, which is obviously the most important. So, you know, There are very good teams, and there are very good players, and there are teams with means, and and so it's going to be a great challenge, as it always is, and we look forward to stepping up and meeting that challenge and being one of the best teams in this division.
Jeff, good luck this season. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.